This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check in with Meredith Colias-Pete, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune, about the stories that she's put out there online as well as in the print edition of the paper. And as always, Meredith, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Of course.
Well, let's start out first here on the latest here involving some charter schools in Gary and in Meredith. There's some financial problems, which is, I guess, not surprising these days, but especially for charter schools. Tell us what you've discovered in your reporting about these two particular schools.
Sure. Well, the state released a batch of like five private audits of charter schools last month. Really, the takeaway to come out of them is that we found two charter schools, particularly Thea Bowman Academy in Gary and the Higher Institute of Arts and Technology in Maryville, are both in the past couple years running really pretty significant deficits. They are both run by the same company, Indianapolis-based Failing Leadership Academies. Basically, Thea Bowman last year was running about $1 million deficit.
Wow.
It lost about 70 students or so. So, you know, education-wise, the money that comes, it follows the students. So when you lose students, you're losing the operational money for the school. Maryville's Higher Institute of Arts and Technology, and this was an audit that covered about 2 years ago, was running about, $450,000 deficit or so. And Thea Bowman has about 1,000 students, but the Maryville school in particular is a pretty tiny school with only 150 students.
Mm-hmm. And I understand that there's another school, too, that's one out of East Chicago that's been running a deficit, too, but not nearly as bad as the other schools, I guess.
Right. And the same company that did all these audits also found that the East Chicago Urban Enterprise Academy had about $158,000 deficit in the last school year. They have said that they've closed it since then.
Yeah. Well, I know that they have to keep a close eye on, in particular, because of all the pressure that the public and educators in particular, and just legislators, too, have put on the private charter school system in Indiana, since it's taken away very dramatically from the enrollment and the operations at public schools, and in Gary in particular, and probably, I guess, to a lesser extent, in Maryville and even East Chicago, too. So I can understand why they're very concerned about this, too. What are you finding in your reporting here about how these schools are doing as to whether they're going to find a way to be able to bring back some of the money that they're losing?
Right. Well, that's definitely the question here. Sort of the common ways to deal with this kind of situation is that they say that they're looking to increase enrollment, cut their budget, make sure that there's an appropriate balance of teachers to students, and they're looking for outside grants. You know, the jury is still out at this point. These audits just came out last month, and so we're just going to have to kind of wait and see how, successful they'll be.
Okay. One of the other stories that you had in print and online here also involves schools, in this particular case about public schools and about a school safety referenda. Tell us about what this new measure that's in the hopper in the General Assembly this time around is taking up and maybe what they would like to be able to do if it gets passed.
Right. I mean, as you know, school safety is probably the number one issue in education right now, especially since last February when you had that horrible shooting in Florida. Even within Indiana, past year or so, there were two school shootings, one in Noblesville and one in Richmond, I believe. Mm-hmm. So a lawmaker from sort of central east Indiana has floated this proposal. What it comes down to is it would create a third category of referendums that would allow schools to raise money for safety costs. And what that means in particular is that it would allow schools, if this passed, to put a property tax hike on the ballot for voters to approve. So it's basically creating a category where schools can ask local property owners to raise taxes for local security needs.
No, then that would mean there'll be, as you say, three categories, which, of course, the two existing, which we've had many referenda, it seems like, here in Northwest Indiana over in recent years, would be, of course, operating expenses as well as building maintenance and new construction expenses as well. So if this passes, there would be the third that specifically would address the school safety issues. You did a little research here under levies and all. How did you break it out here for some of our listeners here?
Sure. Are you talking about in terms of how much money this would raise?
That is, how much it would raise and that sort of thing, if the bill passes and it gets enacted into law.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is research that's been done by like a state legislative agency. What they found is over the period, if this passes, you would be looking at different dollar amounts. Like a smaller district like River Forest, for example, Lake County, if they passed a levy like this, could raise, for example, like $80,000 over the period of the referendum, which is meant for up to 10 years, a little bit longer than the referendums that are on the books right now. But if you're looking at a bigger school system, like Central, for example, they're estimating that they could raise $2 million. Valparaiso, Chesterton out in Porter County could be around $1 million that they could raise. But, you know, what's in the story as well, I mean, and this money would go for, you know, things that schools are already paying for right now, which is essentially they're paying a portion of the salaries for school cups, for example, like threat assessments, safety plans, equipment for emergency responses, like mental health issues, all these kind of things that, you know, schools are looking at right now. The issue with a potential referendum like this that you're seeing right now with the two referendums that are on the books right now is that you're seeing this trend where more affluent communities, for example, like Munster, Valparaiso, are able to pass referendums because they're able to make that case to voters to raise taxes to support schools, where other a little bit less affluent districts like Lake Ridge would be a perfect example. It had two referendums fail in November. And so some of the criticism that you're seeing from local folks, too, is that if this passes, you could very potentially see a divide where more wealthy communities would have this, where less wealthy communities wouldn't necessarily be able to make that case.
Now, you mentioned that you had a chance to talk converse on email with some of the local school officials or staffers who are very familiar with the school budgets and school finances and what kind of impact that if this bill were to become law might have. And you mentioned about the fact that school districts, I know what Superintendent Nick Brown has to supervise in Maryville is one of those who's very concerned about the fact that, as you just mentioned, the richer school districts would come up with more money, and they need the money just as badly, or if not more so, than the more affluent school districts do.
Yeah, absolutely. And a referendum is optional. The local districts weigh a lot of things, you know, primarily if they think that they can win, if they really, really need the money, stuff like that. But that is the issue. It's a traditional, typical argument that you see between like local schools, for example, and the state, where these local people are basically just saying, we would appreciate money, but it should come from the state, not from local taxpayers. That's their argument. So, their argument is if they get money directly from the state, then it's more equitable, more even, rather than having, a potential situation, as we've mentioned, where, this would favor richer districts, basically.
We're talking with Meredith Coleus-Pete, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune, about the stories that she's put out online as well as in print in the newspaper. One story in particular, actually, I guess more of a feature than anything else, that came out around the Christmas season time is very interesting, and I'd like for you to go into more detail about it. It's about two sisters that were long lost, that they've been separated for decades. They finally had the reunion, and I guess it's being called the biggest Christmas gift ever. Tell us about these ladies, more about them, where they came from, and how they ended up meeting each other here to be able to have this reunion.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's really, really an extraordinary story. You have a woman, Leanna Hall, who's about 26, and she lives in Michigan City now. Over the Christmas holiday, a long-lost sister who basically grew up in Sweden found her, and they reunited over the holidays. Like, the backstory to that is both of these ladies were born in Odessa, Ukraine, originally. They have the same parents, same mom and dad. Leanna is the older one. Mom and dad, unfortunately, were heroin addicts, so as you can imagine, she has some pretty tough memories of her early years kind of growing up in that situation.
Oh, yeah.
It came to a head where grandma had really kind of tried to, raise her, try to take care of her, but it was just kind of a really tough situation, and she was coping as well with, mom's heroin addiction, basically. Eventually, Leanna was sent to an orphanage, and when she was like 12, 14 or so, had got adopted and moved to rural Valparaiso, and then kind of grew up over here, went to Chesterton High School. Growing up, just because of the instability of her early years, her Ukrainian grandmother kind of told her, hey, you had a sister once, but believed that she had died, and so didn't have any siblings. The real story is apparently that a couple years later, after Leanna was born, Mom had another baby, born 3 months premature. Her name is Nadia. Apparently, the baby was abandoned at the hospital and recovered, obviously, for a couple months. And when she was well enough to leave the hospital, the hospital basically sent her to an orphanage. Age four, Nadia gets adopted by a couple in Sweden, goes to Sweden, and grows up. And Nadia, the younger one, basically is growing up, knows she's Ukrainian. It's obviously, you know, when you're brown-haired, brown-eyed, a little bit different growing up in Sweden, it's, kind of a noticeable difference.
Oh, yeah.
And always kind of grew up with the sense that she really wanted to know where she came from. And so I guess as a teenager, she kind of tried. There were kind of like a lot of dead ends, kind of hard to know where to look. The past year, she took the step to even go back to Ukraine to appear in a TV show that sort of specialized in reuniting, separated families and things like that. The Swedish parents had adopted another boy from the same orphanage, but they're not like blood related. So Nadia and the adopted brother went back and appeared on the show. The adopted boy had a ton of relatives that they refined. But in Nadia's case, they kind of told her that, the main relatives, parents, grandma, et cetera, had passed away, which was, pretty disappointing, as you would imagine, for someone that kind of really wanted to know where they came from. But they had a little bit of hope for her because they said, hey, you have this cousin named Dmitry who's in Ukraine, and we've been able to track him down. Sort of gave him, gave her the Facebook page for him. She tracked him down, and Dmitry and his immediate family kind of are really the folks, it looks like, that kind of helped this reunion for the woman in Michigan City, because the cousin Dmitry apparently remembered the older sister, kind of remembered her around the family, was able to locate like the orphanage that Liana, the older sister, had kind of grown up in for a while. Fortunately for them in Ukraine, they're not like America. They're a little more open about releasing adoption records. And so they were able to find for the younger sister, like, the records and the adopted name and where the older sister was in America. And they found the Facebook page, and that's how they connected through Facebook. And you'd imagine for Liana, the older sister here in the region, no idea that, it's been set over a decade. She's established this life in the States, has a little bit of ties to the Ukraine, but, has a life here. No idea she had any family members, and here this woman from Sweden contacts her, and she clicks on the Facebook page and is like blown away because this woman looks exactly like her mom.
Now, I understand that we're going up now to fast forward, I guess, in a way to December 17th. Tell us about this very, very emotional reunion that happened in all places, O'Hare International Airport in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, the two sisters had talked for a while on Facebook, basically, and had some phone conversations. And, when it became apparent that this was a real thing, because I think that this was in the story, but the younger sister, Nadia's adopted parents, were initially a little bit wary of it, because you would imagine that they just didn't want to bring up bad memories or, expose her to, like, a difficult situation. But, when the girls were talking and talking, like, for hours each night, and the Swedish adopted parents were, like, pretty convinced that this was a real thing, they paid to have Nadia fly to Chicago. And so she landed at O'Hare from Sweden, and Liana was there to meet her, and you can imagine that it was pretty emotional. I mean, these women, if you would meet them in person, I mean, you could tell from the pictures and the story. They look very alike. They really have, like, a striking similarity. They act like sisters. They took this online DNA test that, confirms that they're siblings, and so they have... Over the holidays, they kind of hung out and got to know each other and, went around in the region.
That's great. That's great. We have time just for one more story, if we can, Meredith. And it's going from an emotional reunion with real people involved that have been seen each other for decades to some high-tech stuff. Tell us about what Ryan Germick, if I'm pronouncing his name right, has done involving some software that Google puts out there, and how he's been able to share his passions, at least on the social media.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ryan is a designer for Google. He's sort of on the team that creates Google Doodles. And if you've used Google at all, you've probably seen it.
Oh, yeah, I love those. Those are great. Those are really, really good. Yeah, really creative, especially the when there's an animated one up there, too. I mean, something more than just cute animals up there dancing. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, for anyone out there that's not familiar, if you go to Google.com, from time to time they mark anniversaries or like a famous or well-known person's birthday or something, that they have this kind of cool little illustration or, like you said, like a little animated thing. You click on it, it goes through a Google search, and it kind of tells you about that person and their anniversary or whatnot. So Ryan is on the team, and he's kind of one of the lead people for about 10 years now that's kind of helped create those Google Doodles. He's kind of like an illustrator by, you know, by trade. So it's definitely a cool little job. And
I know that he's learned a lot from artists, obviously, because that's what his line of work is. Of course, although it's electronically now, but he had a chance, I guess, growing up in Munster, that he got the chance to watch Lakeshore Public Television and other PBS programs, and he seemed to really dote on Bob Ross. You know, it's something, yeah. I guess, carrying the happy little mountains and trees one step further.
Yeah, indeed. So growing up, he's a Maryville High School grad, graduated like 98 or so. So he's, you know, 38 now. Always grew up as an art kid, as you mentioned. Loved Bob Ross. Bob Ross was a huge inspiration for him. Took classes at the center in Munster, you know, and after high school, that was kind of his message to Maryville High School kids last week, is that after high school, he sort of went out there, made his own path. He got out to New York City, studied at the Parsons School of Design, which, if you're not familiar, is a pretty famous art school out in New York City. Studied with one man who helped create the MTV logo. So, you know, pretty high in their field. You know, had this sort of adventurous life afterwards, lived in India for a while, taught English in Japan, kind of just to go there, you know, indulged himself and kind of was... you know, kind of living the life that he wanted to live, and that kind of led him to Google, where he got hired. A couple years later, he fell into the Google Doodle team. Excuse me.
Now, I know, Meredith, that you got involved in not only having the conversation with Ryan to find out all this and learn more about him too, but it's all because of a very special national contest that Google's putting out there for anybody who comes up with a Google Doodle, and they submit that. I guess they could win a big prize.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and a shout-out to anyone that is interested, for sure. Every year, Google holds this contest where they open it up to anyone, kindergarten to 12th grade across the country, even kids that are homeschooled, to create their own Google Doodle. There is always a theme every year, and you can go get more information on Google.com. But the national winner basically will get a $30,000 scholarship, $50,000 in sort of technology for the school, and you get your Google Doodle posted on Google.com for one day. So it is a pretty cool deal. You know, locally a couple years ago, a Lake Central freshman won the state contest, so she got a little bit of publicity for that too.
That's wonderful. Well, Meredith, thank you so much for the great stories that you've been able to tell us about here that you've had out there in print and online in the Post Tribune, and we hope to have you again with more stories to tell too.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you.
Meredith Colias-Pete is reporter for the Post Tribune. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we continue on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday. I'm checking with Carol Carlson, who's with the Post Tribune also, and the chuck on the stories that she has put out there as well, too, and a lot of them related with education stories and other city news from the city of Gary. As always, Carol, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Chris. Happy Thursday.
Thank you. Same to you. Let's jump in here, and we actually have a combination of a local story and a legislative story here to start out with. Some work Senator Andy Melton has been getting his proposals all together, has introduced the bills he wants to bring up in the General Assembly this session, has put them in the hopper, so to speak. And one of them is a very important story that deals with economic development and casinos for the city of Gary. Tell us about that.
Correct. It's a Senate bill that many expected to be introduced, and Senator Melton was the one that introduced it. It's basically an economic stimulus bill for Gary, and it addresses the issue of Gary holding two casino licenses and the recent sale or transaction of the property, the Majestic Star, which currently owns both those licenses. And it's a little complicated, and there's got a lot of moving pieces to it. Basically, it would provide some money for Gary pretty quickly with the transfer of one of those licenses. It does not say where that license would go. It just specifies it would have to be 100 miles away from Gary. Gary would retain the other license, and it would move a casino inland. It also doesn't specify a location for that.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that in conversations we've had with Ed Feigenbaum, who keeps track of what happens as far as the gaming industry in Indiana is concerned, he's talked about this and it's come up in other conversations. And also, we know that there are a number of communities that have expressed interest in having that second casino license. But it sounds like that if this bill goes through, it specifically states it would have to be quite a ways away from Gary. So that kind of narrows down the list of potential cities, probably places like Terre Haute.
Yeah, the speculation, of course, is on Terre Haute because one of the new owners, the entity that's purchasing the Majestic Star Enterprise, is called Spectacle Entertainment, and one of their main principals is someone who lives in Terre Haute and has expressed an interest in the past in an inland casino in Terre Haute. So that's the city that everybody thinks that this would be steered to. But of course, there's a lot of angst in Lake County over the moving of Majestic Star to an inland location, giving them a possible leg up on the other boats that are still basically on Lake Michigan.
Right. We all mentioned, too, that as part of this measure, it's an economic development measure, and that Senator Melton, who has been on a standing committee, looked into it. In fact, they had a delegation show up for a big tour of the property up there along the lake, and that's how I think that he was able to help put more of the components together for this measure that he's introduced. Talk about, if you will, about how the Buffington Harbor in particular fits into not only what he's proposing in this bill, but also the goals for the city of Gary in general.
Well, it was sometime during the summer or in the fall, I believe, this legislation delegation did come up here. And interestingly, Senator Ryan Mishler, who is chairman of the Appropriations Committee, where Melton has his bill right now, was among those who came up. And the city showed the delegation the area of Buffington Harbor and how industrial that area is, with several entities, Carmuse, Lime, and others. There's a stevedore company there now, and Gary has established this port authority, and one of the goals of Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson to turn Buffington Harbor into an industrial port and remove Majestic Star. She just doesn't think it's a good fit for that area.
It's probably true.
I guess they came away with a favorable opinion that this could be a good idea, or at least that's what we're being told that they thought. They've expressed some favorable comments about their trip.
And I know, too, that the bill also calls for some education component in there, too, dealing, I think, mainly with Ivy Tech Community College, but it kind of expands as well, too. So there are a lot of, as you say, a lot of moving parts, moving pieces that's in Senator Melton's proposal.
Yeah, the education component, I spoke with Mayor Freeman Wilson about the bill, and she's largely interested in the development of the port and the money that they could use from the license. They would get a portion of the proceeds of the movement of that license, and for 20 years they'd get 20% of the casino proceeds from that license. So it would be a continuous revenue generator for the city without any expenditures involved. So it's a great deal. But the education component is Senator Melton's idea. One of his big concerns is workforce development. He sees this as an opportunity to shore up a lot of the shortcomings that people who live in Gary face when they go to seek employment.
Well, do you think also, too, that this has something to do with the fact that then he's, of course, sponsored the measures that have basically created the state takeover for the Gary Community School Corporation? Do you think that maybe this is a way, too, that he'd like to see improvements that are made in general for education in Gary, and this is just one way to help boost workforce development that way?
Yeah, I think it's clear to the legislature that Gary financially is in such a hole that it's going to take such a tremendous amount of money to get out of that hole that they're not going to have any money for capital improvements or to build a new school of any kind, that money is just not going to be there from the way the current property tax state revenue situation is set up. So I think this was kind of an end run around that to get more money for that kind of development. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a bill we're all going to keep a very close eye on as it moves through the General Assembly and hopefully makes it out of the Senate and into the House. I'm sure that with the sponsors, I'm sure that Senator Melton's already lined up for the measure. When it gets that far, it'll come up again, too. We'll find out. One of the other stories that you have up on the list here that you've covered and put out there in print and online, among several here that involve education, is one that has come up with concern about the Gary Middle School. Tell us about that.
Well, it opened in August, and it was rather hastily put together, and they've run into a lot of problems, the largest being that there's just too many kids for the size of the school. They've got over 1,000 kids, and as a result, it's led to large class sizes and difficulty for teachers to manage those class sizes, especially with middle school, pretty rambunctious age. And there's been some discipline problems, and there's been some fights, and in an effort to lower these class sizes, they've actually had to purchase some portable buildings that are sitting outside the middle school, which is pretty ironic in a school district with some 33 vacant buildings that they're trying to sell, that they're housing their middle school students in a building that's not big enough for them.
One of the other stories, too, involving the Gary school system here, besides the changes that had to be made because of the issues at Gary Middle School, is also dealing with Wirt Emerson, the School of Visual Performing Arts, which had to close, because at least it was a decision of the previous emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley, to close it up to shift the students over into Westside High School. And now, I guess, because it's closed up, there are some issues which, as we all know, have basically been problems that all of the closed Gary Community Schools are facing. Tell us about the theft issues these days.
Unfortunately, someone stripped, I'm not sure how that works, but they removed the copper wiring from these transformers around the school, and that immediately disconnected the service to the school. So they'd had some security lights on, and those are out now. And besides losing the copper wiring, you know, they lost the light. And there's also been some issues with some graffiti scribbled on one of the walls, and there's some dumping beginning. So some of the residents in Miller are starting to be alarmed, and they're voicing concerns to the new emergency manager, Pete Maricas.
I know that certainly not only residents in the Miller neighborhood where the building is located and where the students once roam through the neighborhood, I guess now the concerns about the fact that it's vandalism that's happened there, and there have been other cases too. I guess one of the cases that you mentioned in the story as well too, but the residents obviously realize there has to be something done, certainly on a security measure, but probably say they'd like to expand it with the problems that they have with the buildings that have been long vacant. Like Nobel Elementary School.
Yeah, one of the people I talked to, who's a community activist who lives near Wirt Emerson, pointed to Nobel Elementary, which is literally just a shell. The building is just a shell. It's just been ravaged. It's about as bad as you can imagine.
Wow.
And it just looks like it's a bombed-out building somewhere. It's wide open. The walls are gone, and the only thing that's essentially standing is the frame. And it's located in an area that not a lot of people see. It's way off the beaten track, so not many people are aware of it.
Mm-hmm.
This person was, and she doesn't want, you know, to be looking at that on one of Gary's main arteries. I mean, it's the entrance to Marquette Park, where nearly $30 million was spent to renovate the park. And you don't want a big looming eyesore right outside your park.
Now, Carol, I know we talked here just briefly about the Gary Middle School and the problems there, the overcrowding problems, to be sure. And I know that your story also covers some changes that had to be made in leadership there. Tell us what happened and what's going to come about with the person who used to be in charge.
Well, the new emergency manager, as I mentioned before, Pete Maricas, held a series of public forums when he came on board in November and in December. And what he learned obvious issues at the middle school, and he heard that from parents and some of the discipline issues, and he would not tell me why, but he said he needed to make a change at the middle school, so the principal there was removed from her post, and she is in another post in an assistant principal-type position. And he brought back Lucille Washington, who is a pretty well-regarded former Gary administrator who's retired. She, when Peggy Hinckley, the original emergency manager, came on board, she tapped Mrs. Washington to be the director of academics on an interim basis until she hired a full-time person. So Mrs. Washington is someone who everybody respects, and she's known for handling discipline issues well, and you know they think that she will get this middle school straightened out. And in the meantime, Pete Maricus is exploring moving some of the students from the current middle school to Bailey, which is now a little confusing, but Bailey is now an elementary school, originally built as a middle school in Glen Park. So if they do that, that should solve a lot of the problems, but they'll be bringing another school online.
Well, it sounds like it was rather serendipitous that they happen to have a building that used to be a middle school, that if they have to transform it back to a middle school, mm-hmm. that at least it'll be there and it's easy to do. They don't have to worry about putting up any more portable classrooms or right. having to find some other space. It probably will be easy enough, relatively easy at least, to shift students on the elementary grades to other buildings
right.
and be able to fit them in there too. Yeah, one of the other stories that, Carol, I know that you worked on too, as well, too, is coming up that people should be aware of. If they've never attended any of the town hall forums that Congressman Pete Bisconsky puts up every year about this time of year across his district, which, of course, includes Lake Porter and LaPorte counties, here's a chance to find out more, to have their say as about the issues in Washington. And I'm sure that probably this series of town hall meetings that you can tell us about will certainly be of light, because they'll be talking about the government shutdown.
Yeah, I would imagine that we'll hear a lot of feedback, or Pete will get a lot of feedback from his constituents about this shutdown. And his meetings start tomorrow. I just pulled up my list. The first one is tomorrow at 10 a.m. in East Chicago, followed by a noon meeting at Purdue Northwest, and then at 2 he'll be at the Dyer Sherrville Library, 4 o'clock Crown Point Civic Center, and he wraps up at 6 o'clock tomorrow at Colbert City Hall. And then he's got another full slate of meetings on Saturday. And, of course, Pete is a Democrat and one of the people who is part of the House delegation that is holding strong in passing measures and moving them over to the Senate side for consideration that would essentially end the shutdown and push it into a negotiation session and bring federal workers back to work, but the Senate Majority Leader won't bring those bills to the floor.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, obviously we have the advantage with having Congressman Bisconsky being our representative, and him being the veteran lawmaker that he is very much a senior member when it comes to issues dealing with appropriations for the Department of Defense.
Yes, I think it's the first time that he's held that chairmanship.
And that's right.
That particular committee probably handles more federal spending than any other House committee. I am pretty certain.
Wow.
Defense spending is, you know, right up there, one of the top revenue things in the federal budget there.
One of the other stories that you've had a chance to check out, and we've been able to see online as well as in print in the Post Tribune, has been a very interesting opportunity to bring a bit of history of the city of Gary together in one room for a little while. We're talking about the Living Mayors Roundtable Forum that was held recently at Indiana University Northwest. Tell us the participants and what they had to say.
Well, all of the past mayors were there. That would include Richard Gordon Hatcher from the 60s. Into the 80s, and he was followed by Thomas Barnes, who ushered in the casino era, who was followed by Scott King, and for a brief period, we had Dozier Allen, very brief period, about 18 days. I had to go back into our archive and see how long he was there.
Uh-huh. Well, Well, he was not mayor for very long, as I recall, in looking at it too myself.
There was a caucus held by the Democrats in Gary, and they ended up selecting Rudy Clay. I think Clay won by 2 votes, and so Dozier was short-lived in that role. And of course, Mayor Freeman Wilson was there. Six decades of Gary mayors.
Wow. What did many of the mayors have to say, the living mayors, aside, we'll say, from Mayor Freeman Wilson? She's the current mayor. But what did the history side of the mayoralty have to say about what's been going on in the city of Gary and improvements that the city officials are trying to make?
Well, most of the mayors, well, probably all of them who spoke to it, were very supportive of what Freeman Wilson is doing and sympathetic to some of the problems she's facing, and their issues were not to minimize their issues, but I believe that financially anyway, she's looking at much stronger headwinds than they were. That there was when Hatcher was mayor, there was Democrats in the White House and sympathetic Democrats, especially after the King assassination, and federal money was flowing pretty well into Gary for a while there. And when Barnes took office, of course, it was the casino era, and that money came into Gary in pretty good amount that Scott King was the benefactor of, and he established one of his big projects was this U.S. Steel Yard in Railcats Baseball Stadium.
I know your story, too. It goes into a bit of detail as well, too, about what has happened in the city of Gary in a way. In fact, something that the people I know, and in turn, Mayors Hatcher and Barnes were blaming on state government for getting rid of that buffer zone. And maybe people don't recall what the buffer zone's all about, because that's made some changes that we're facing today.
It began under Hatcher, and there was an exodus, a white flight from Gary under Hatcher. And a lot of those people just simply picked up and went south into the community of Merrillville, which was an unincorporated community at that time, and it was directly adjacent to Gary's southern border. And there was speculation a little bit before my time there, but there was speculation that Gary was eyeing this community, Merrillville, and would annex it. You know, to what cities do, they annex to extend their properties, extend their property tax base, you know, make themselves larger. And to combat that, there was legislation that was passed by the state legislature that eliminated a buffer zone that had to be observed for cities interested in, for towns interested in incorporating. And as a result of that provision, Merrillville incorporated itself as a town and headed off the annexation bid from Gary.
Well, you have to go into more detail by looking at the story that's online as well as in print in the Post Tribune about what the mayors had to say. They had some other great comments as well, too, but unfortunately we're out of time today, Carol, but we'll have more time another time to have a chance to chat and find out the later stories that you're working on as well. Thank you for sharing the information with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
And you've been listening to Carol Carlson, who's a reporter for the Post Tribune. This is Regionally Speaking. The Unity Barbershop on the south side of Fort Wayne offers peace and hope to its regulars, as well as a good a haircut, thanks to its owner, who is known to the community. He serves as Foundation One. To learn the scope of the foundation's work, reporter Julia Meek had a chance to sit down with him to talk about what motivates his passion for both sides of his craft and how he can make a difference with this rather unique platform.
Foundation One, welcome.
Welcome.
Now, you've got a mission of peace and unity as your barbershop name and your own name, Carrie Proudly, to the point and from your heart. Why do you do what you do, and why do you do it there?
We've been placed on earth to help people and have compassion for people. Doing it at the barbershop in the heart of the city is where it's at, because a lot of people don't want to do what I do, or a lot of people are afraid to do what I do.
And when did it all begin?
30 years ago, me and my wife at the time, we had our nephew staying with us, and I started cutting their hair in the garage. And it just, clientele started building, and then Kim Woodson, my sister, told me to go to barber school. I had never heard of barber school. That was the beginning.
Apparently you like the craft because you're still doing it.
Yes, I do. I love the craft.
And the helping people?
Yes.
All goes together in your heart.
Yes.
Now, that Southside neighborhood is a grand old one, and you're in one of those ever-vital hubs there on Pontiac Street. Who all can you interact with directly from that platform?
I interact with everyone, from the mayor's office to the chief of police to the Urban League president to teachers to reporters to criminals to the mentally ill to the homeless to the afflicted, drug addicts. It's so many people that need help.
How do they find you, or how do you find them and bring them all together there?
I think everything is a spiritual connection, you know. Sometimes you don't know, it just happens, a spiritual connection.
I get that, but making those connections, making those networks, are people feeling free to come and see you?
Oh, yes. I've had a lot of people come and tell me they was getting ready to commit a crime, and I would share with them, and they wouldn't commit a crime. So
oh,
I was like,
powerful.
Always come and talk to me before you do it, because if you talk to me after, I can't help you.
That's a great point. If it's meaningful talk, it's thinking, critical thinking, as you like to call it, and then talking about it. What kind of a power does that have? Just the word and the timing of the word.
The type of power that'll save a life. I've had gang members come to me want to kill another gang member. So I would talk to that gang member, and then I would go talk to the other gang member, and we'll squash it.
A direct mediation,
yes.
To be sure. Intervention,
yes.
Sometimes is what you
yes.
got to do.
Yes, I mean, that is it. Yes.
And you never seem to back away or not have an answer. You will find an answer.
I believe that I was placed in a position with the proper tools and just use them when that time come, you know, because it's needed right now. It's needed real bad right now.
Indeed. And what values do you feel that you have added to the vibe of that neighborhood and can add?
Peace, you know, peace is one of the values that I add, because sometimes the mind is being mentally challenged or disturbed. And if you can bring peace to the mind, then that will cut down a lot of criminal activities.
So bottom line, Foundation, no matter who did what to get in the tight spot they're in, how can you give them and their families hope?
A lot of times by just talking to them, going to court with them. A lot of mothers be having problems with little boys and the father's not there. Mm-hmm. So I have them just drop the little brother off at the barbershop for a few hours and let him be around some structure and some discipline.
That's fantastic.
You know, give him a break, because it's real tough right now being a parent. You know, if you can just be a support group to somebody, you can help somebody. Not just me, but the whole staff at the barbershop.
And how big is the staff at your barbershop?
It's five.
All right, that's a full shop. Now, you're a righteous mentor and role model to many, many people. Who are your role models?
My mother, my daughter, K2 Oladawan, Mike Patterson, Malcolm X, Harriet Tubman, Roger Miller, people who've overcame issues. It seems like I'm attracted to people who are resilient and overcomers.
Okay, if you could add one more way to spread your word, what would it be?
And start going into these schools and reaching these young brothers at a very, very young age. You know, like I just finished a 10-week anger workshop last month at Wood Youth Center. I was out there mentoring young brother
good
every
for
Monday.
You. Mm-hmm.
Don't give up on them. Don't look down on them, but just help them. I don't want to never have to hurt nobody. I just want to help people. It makes me feel better.
Amen to that, and it sounds like you're going to carry it on.
Till I die.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, let me do this work till I die. I don't.
Now, this is a fresh new year we're greeting, Foundation. So before I let you get back to business, what wish or thought would you like to share with our community?
I wish more people would remove their fear and jump in, and let's help save our community. Let's not look at them, say anything negative, just help them. Because when they showing you these negative behavior, they're showing you that they need help.
Community Advocate and Activist Foundation One is manager of the Unity Barbershop. Thank you so much for sharing your powerful story with us today. Foundation, peace and blessings to you and yours.
Peace and blessings to you and yours also.
You know, a little while ago, I sat down to try to write a song about state of the world, you know, kind of a blues thing, I guess you could call it, or whatever. Talk about what was going on, because I see so many people these days upset about things going on in politics, things going on in organized religion, craziness all across social media, and folks wondering what's going to happen, and particularly folks being upset that it looks like people are getting away with craziness, telling the biggest lies in the world, abusing people and getting away with it. And
what you're hearing, by the way, is a song called God Don't Like Ugly. That's by Fort Wayne musician Michael Patterson, who is inspired by Foundation One's work and message. You can find out more information at the Foundation One Unity Barbershop Facebook page. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Looking at what else has happened in the news lately, in particular another conversation with a visitor to Northwest Indiana, Vicki Henn, the Executive Vice President and the Chief Human Resources Officer for the PNC Financial Services Group, was the keynote speaker for the Michigan City Chamber of Commerce 100 Inspiring Women Luncheon recently. She serves on the board of the PNC Foundation, and she's also the executive director of the PNC Multicultural Employee Business Resource Group. She's a recipient of a PNC Performance Award, which is the bank's highest employee honor. She recently talked with Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson from the Blue Chip Casino Stardust Event Center, where she was, to talk about the keynote address that she had given, which included being a working mother, and looks into the notion as well of a good work-life balance. And here's the conversation.
As a member of PNC's Corporate Diversity Council, can you tell us how you make the case for diversity in your organization?
So we don't, it's interesting, this notion of business case for diversity. Honestly, at PNC, I would say it's an essential part of our talent-focused culture. So we don't treat diversity and inclusion as a separate program. It's part of our talent strategy. And so in order to have the highest performing, best talent that we can have, frankly, that requires us to have a diverse team. And it requires us to have an inclusive culture, an inclusive environment where people want to work. So our Corporate Diversity Council is very, very focused on working with my team in human resources to create talent-focused strategies that help us to attract diverse talent and then, most importantly, retain diverse talent in the organization so that we have a pipeline of talent for future leadership positions across the board.
Since the Michigan City Chamber of Commerce Luncheon is all about 100 inspiring women and their contributions to the chamber, what are some of the ways you have benefited from or worked with female advocates in advancing your career?
Well, women supporting women is important and has been important for me, certainly. So it's probably been less about, you know, people ask me, have I had mentors or have I been part of programs? Those are really important parts of dynamic cultures. I would say for me personally, it's always been having women that either I worked with or that I worked for, that sometimes worked for me, that I could learn from, that took an interest in me, that offered me coaching, that sometimes pushed me when I didn't have a lot of confidence in myself. And so I'm a big believer just in the support network of women. And by the way, looking for coaches wherever they might be. So I try and really focus the women that work in our organization, not just to think about, you know, the women above them in leadership positions, but some of the best advice, the best coaching, the best support I've received over my 25 years at PNC have been from the women that I work with, you know, from the women that work for me. So you have to be willing to be open and looking for that coaching and support wherever you can find it. And then to provide it to others as well. I think it's a real gift we can give to each other.
2018 has been dubbed the Year of the Woman, with a record number of women elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. You are about to deliver a keynote address to 100 inspiring women. What woman or women inspire you and why?
That's a great question. I should have thought of that before you asked me. You know, I can't, it would be hard for me to think of one woman. I think that certainly when I think about the female caregivers that I know who not only are inspiring, you know, day to day from a professional perspective, but are also people that are involved in their community, that are taking care of whether it's elderly parents, whether it's children, what have you. I think those are the women that are most inspiring, women who frankly give of themselves in all facets of their life. That's been very inspiring for me. And something that honestly I've looked to in my career, this notion of work-life balance, I think is a bit of a fallacy and puts a lot of pressure on us because it's hard to balance everything. You can't do everything really well at one time. But the people that have inspired me, the women that have inspired me are women who frankly, do the best they can in the situation they're in at any given time, and just every day have that same sort of discipline and that same approach to their life. So some days it might be they're giving their all professionally. Other days they might be giving their all to a friend who is in need, or a somebody who's sick, or a community group that needs their help. Those are the women that inspire me. And frankly, that's what I try to emulate myself in my leadership and in my life as well.
It is both timely as well as interesting that you brought up the conversation around the whole work-life balance for women being a fallacy. In Michelle Obama's book, Becoming, she challenges Facebook executive Sheryl Sandberg in her book, Lean In, about women being able to do it all. So it's great to hear it from not only a former first lady, but it is also refreshing and almost reassuring to hear it from you.
It is funny. I remember when Lean In came out, and I would make that comment, so some people loved it, embraced it, and other people told me I should go read her book, which I said, I have read her book. No disrespect. And by the way, I don't think Sheryl Sandberg probably appreciated or meant for it to come up the way it did at the time either. But the truth of the matter is, and I think it's for anybody, there's no such thing as perfect balance. And our ability to talk about it and to be open about it and to be more transparent is half the battle, right? Because I think that if we set up these ideas that a woman should be able to do everything flawlessly, then we're part of the problem. So I'm very open. I have 4 children. I've got a big job. I'm very involved at home, involved in my community. And every day something suffers, right? So some days I have to be, 80% of me is at work and my kids only get 20%. But those are choices I make. And I do the best I can every day to balance. And every week is different. Every day is different. And I think we have to support each other and just appreciate that. And that's how we can help each other thrive. That's how we can help each other be successful. And that's what inspires me.
And finally, Vicki, what is the one leadership lesson that you've learned in your career that you would like to share with other inspiring women?
The one lesson for me that I do think tends to be, from a gender perspective, I think a bit more acute in females is I wish I had learned earlier not to make assumptions. So I had a real issue, I would say, earlier in my career with, if someone didn't say hello to me when I was walking by them, if I was in a meeting and someone wasn't overly enthusiastic about an idea I had, I immediately became very self-conscious and assumed that I must have done something wrong. I must not be working hard enough. And I immediately thought, very self-centered, actually, as I think back about it, it had to be about me. I never really appreciated that, hey, maybe someone's having a bad day. Maybe someone's got a lot on their mind, right? It's not. And I lost a lot of time. I think I spent a lot of wasted energy caring a little bit too much and assuming a little too much that I must be doing something wrong. I must not be working hard enough. And I wish I had learned earlier in my career and in life in general, by the way, this is just a life lesson for me, to take things as they are, right? If you know you're doing good work, if you're working hard, if you're being a kind person, a good person, all you can do is control yourself. And you have to hope that people will see that. And if you feel in a moment that that's not being reciprocated, it doesn't have to be about you. It could be about other things going on, and not to get paralyzed by that. I wish I had learned that earlier.
That's Vicki Hinn, Executive Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer for the PNC Financial Services Group. Thank you, Vicki, for spending time with us today.
Okay, thank you.
And thanks to our reporters from the Post-Tribune, Meredith Colius-Pete and Carol Carlson, for joining us on Regionally Speaking Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.